Welcome to episode 13 of the Swansea Cyber Law and Security Podcast. I'm Sarah Correa, a doctoral researcher at Swansea University.
And I'm Patrick Bishop. I'm a senior lecturer also at Swansea University.
And today we have a very special guest, Kate Hopkins, which I'll let you introduce yourself. Hi, Kate.
Hi, everyone. Hi, I'm Kate. I'm a doctoral researcher in Cardiff University at the Data Justice Lab, and I'm very excited to be here.
We're very excited to have you here. Also, this is a very good day for you to be recording a podcast with us because we're recording on the 29th of April. Is it April? Yeah. I can't remember what month we're in anymore.
What day it is, but I know it's April.
And it's actually the Swansea Cardiff Varsity is going on.
Don't get me started.
So, you know, we're in the middle of the COVID lockdown crisis. So obviously the varsity is a sports event. It's a sports competition between Swansea University and Cardiff University, which happens every year. And it's actually happening virtually this year, believe it or not. So anyway, it's we can consider this as another event in the varsity calendar, if you like.
And Kate is very privileged because we wouldn't usually countenance a Cardiff person being involved in our podcast, but we've made a very special exception today.
I know. I feel like I'm on very, very sacred ground right now, and I'm going to watch what I say very, very carefully in the next half an hour.
Rightio. Well, I should also say that, as always, the views expressed on this podcast do not represent those of our employers, research partners, or funders, etc. They are our personal views. So, today we were going to talk about, guess, something COVID-related. And the topic for today is around health data and privacy in the context of the response to the COVID crisis. So there has been some concerns, a little bit of controversy over the way in which government organizations are partnering up with private sector organizations and bringing together a large amount of data in order to draw insights that are relevant to managing this COVID crisis. So we've picked up on a few things on the news. There's been a little bit of coverage, and here I'm going to reserve the analysis to the UK context. I don't know as much what's going on in other countries at the moment. I haven't actually looked beyond, but I should imagine that this is happening not just in the UK, but a lot more widely. So governments are bringing this data together. In order to do that, they're entering into commercial contracts with usually fairly large multinational tech companies. And there's also there's a bit of a proliferation of these apps that have been developed to monitor symptoms, collect local information on infections. And also there's ideas about developing apps which will enable the government to trace the contacts that people who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 have had with other people, so as to enable the lockdown to be relaxed. So if we are able to trace everybody who's been in contact with those infected, you know, if you haven't, then you can sort of resume normal life. That's the idea anyway. So just to give a little bit of context to the discussion here, I'll just say a little bit about what's been happening in the UK, and then we can talk about what our thoughts are on this. So back on the 28th of March, so last month, the government announced a new health data platform that was being put together. So it's a big COVID-19 data store. It's being led by NHS affiliate bodies, so NHS England and Improvement and NHSX, so essentially bodies of the National Health Service here in the UK. So they're leading it. They're collecting together data such as the phone calls that are received by the 111, which is the non-emergency number here, data that was already within the NHS. So, you know, if you know a little bit about the types of data the NHS holds, there's something called the patient register, which includes It's, as it says, it's a register of all patients that have ever registered with a doctor, essentially, and they've got other data sets there as well. They're also bringing together with all of this the test results, data about the availability of NHS resources at a national level, but also at a local level. So, you know, beds in hospitals, that sort of thing. So this initiative is bringing all of this together, linking it all together to try and enable better policy decisions. So you can plan in advance if capacity is being reached, that sort of thing. When you read the government's announcement, it seems to be very much oriented towards these sorts of strategic decisions on resources. That's how it read to me when I first read it. So yeah, so that's the main gist of it. The data is what they call pseudo-anonymized. So once all of these individual data sets, they will have to be linked in some way. So some sort of unique identifier has to be created in it to be able to do this. So in some countries, this is very easy to do because in some countries, people have identity cards that have a number. So there's a unique number for each person, each citizen or each individual who is residing in that country. In the UK, it's not like that. So this is actually a very complicated thing. It might seem simple, but linking together 111 calls with the patient register is actually quite, you know, it's not as easy as linking two numbers that are the same, right? So there's quite a lot of work that goes into just linking all these things together. And once it's linked, then you can consider the data pseudo-anonymized if you remove things like date of birth and name and whatever, and you just leave that unique ID that's linked things together. So to do this, a number of commercial partners have been brought in, and this is where some of the concerns have been raised. So we've got Microsoft is providing the cloud storage facility and some of the infrastructure that allows this work to happen, because obviously we're talking about hugely large data sets. Then we have Palantir Technologies. Palantir is working with a UK-based company called Faculty to actually integrate the data. So the thing that I was describing before of actually taking these individual data sets and finding a way to link the right people together, the right units in each data set together, that's the thing that Palantir and Faculty are doing. And then they're also using some Google G Suite stuff to actually collect data, operational data on the ground from hospitals about occupancy and stuff like that. So, yeah, pretty big companies. They've been brought in to put this data set together so the government can know what's going on, make decisions. And essentially what they're saying is that once this is over, the data will either be destroyed or returned to the NHS. So this is the main story. There's other smaller stories about, you know, the tracing apps, and some of them are being also developed in partnership between governments and tech companies, and others are just being developed by tech companies themselves. So that's also happening in parallel. But I think we could start by talking about this. So this is like a massive data store being created. And yeah, so what are your thoughts? Any initial thoughts?
Kate's obviously a little shy.
I wasn't sure if that was directed at me or Patrick. I can go though. If it's you're throwing it over to me, I can very happily pick that up.
Well, I'll defer to the expert and I'll chip in with my
okay, let's do it that way.
Various occasions.
So for me, this speaks to a sort of a classic underlying argument when we're talking about surveillance, and that's this idea of privacy versus security. So one of the kind of underlying justifications for surveillance of any kind, like, is often citizens are asked to surrender their privacy in order to mitigate a risk. But once that privacy is surrendered, it's often very difficult to claw it back. So if we think about sort of airport security in a sort of a post 9/11 world, for example, the sort of the procedures that we were asked to start doing after 9/11, we've never really seen those kind of drop away, have we? And this is sort of one of the things that has tended to happen. Surveillance measures are introduced as a way to kind of deal with some sort of risk that's been identified. Now, in this particular case, COVID-19, you know, we're not always going to be in lockdown. At some point, we're going to have to kind of open up again. And the questions we sort of really need to be asking ourselves right now are questions around what privacy are we being asked to give up in order to mitigate this risk? And what will happen to our privacy rights once we've got this risk a bit more under control? So that's the sort of the points for me. It sort of really speaks to that very core argument in surveillance studies. But there are also some more obvious questions for me about aligning health data with the commercial partners. So what I sort of I'm interested in is what we know about these companies and the way that they handle their data. So what privacy are we being asked to give up in order to kind of track COVID-19 and to keep some sort of control over it? And once the risk is more under control, is this going to be a permanent change for our privacy rights? Or is there some way we can claw it back? That's going to be sort of kind of interesting. And I'm sort of really interested in this idea about the commercial partners as well. So for me, in an ideal world where the NHS is functioning and it's fully funded, I'd be sort of asking, why can't we do this as part of the NHS's function? Why does this have to be done by commercial companies? Those were my initial thoughts on this story anyway.
Yeah. Did you want to come in on that, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kate's hit the nail right on the head there with the dilemma at the heart of this. I was interested, I was reading a piece by, he's a very prominent computer scientist, Sir Nigel Shadbolt from Oxford. And his view is basically that the normal rule shouldn't apply because this is a public health emergency. So we can, if we split the issues up into two separate ones, so obviously there's what we do with our approach post-COVID-19 crisis and whether we continue with this approach. Because I absolutely take Kate's point that when the state acquires powers for itself, it's always very hesitant to relinquish those powers. You know, we've seen that time and time again. But while we're in the midst of the crisis, I wonder what Kate and you, Sarah, think about that view that, well, if we're talking about a balance here between privacy and the public good, as it were, do we stick fast with the current approach where we highly value privacy, or do we take the view as a society that, well, privacy is now less important and we all need to sacrifice our privacy concerns to help in that public health emergency?
My view is kind of, I think that the government is quite right to do everything in its power with the data that is at its disposal to respond to this crisis in the best way possible. And I think all of that cannot happen without all of this cross-referencing of all of these different disparate databases that the NHS have in different places and other sources of data. I think the only way to respond is to, in a way, you can't do it without those unique identifiers. You can't really link things together to get a broader picture without, at some level, even if it's within the black box of the machine, but at some level, the names, the dates of birth, the addresses, the personal information is essential to create something that is of value here to respond to the public health crisis. So I think that's, it's not just in this crisis. I think in a lot of health-related research, there's a lot of benefits, and other types of research, there is a lot of benefit from being able to look at data in this way and see and test whether things are working and plan ahead in terms of capacity and delivery, all of that. So, but that said, I do have some concerns about, I guess, the what Kate was saying before. So our ability to really be confident that the use of the data will be as contracted. You know, if I'm certain that, you know, whatever contract Palantir has with the government, from what I've seen, at least anyway, but, you know, I'd be very surprised if it wasn't, you know, doing all that it's possible to ensure that the data is only used for the purpose that it's intended. And I mean, that's kind of the legal line in the UK, isn't it? You define how the data is being used and what for, and any use outside of that wouldn't be legal. But it is concerning that to the extent that we are so reliant on these big tech companies to deliver these products, it is concerning whether or not we're able to hold them accountable in any way for any misuse, and whether there is in fact control as to what goes on, you know, in the post-COVID world. So that's one thing. Developing that sort of capacity in-house, I think is the only way to ensure that this kind of research is done in a way that is to the extent that it's possible, accountable, you know, democratically accountable. If a government does something wrong, there is a recourse. You know, they can be voted out of government. They can be held accountable for their actions. What happens, what the decisions Palantir makes, they're not really open to any kind of scrutiny. So that is concerning. But the other thing that I think is worth thinking about is the extent to which being able to identify the individual within these large data sets, and being able to say, okay, these individuals with these characteristics are not, they're for some reason they're proportionately, that, you know, significantly more infected than other groups, for example, or these individuals, we know from their GPS coordinates that they have been more than 5 miles away from their house, or whatever it is. So I think there is a risk that being able to drill down to the individual level could shift responsibility from the wider problem to creating a smaller problem that is a lot more manageable, which is problematic individuals. Which is a lot easier for a government to deal with and claim success at dealing with problematic individuals than it is to deal with the wider issue of public health and, you know, the funding of the NHS and the supply chains and all this blah blah blah. So that's my other concern.
You know, I think you're absolutely right in sort of going back to what you sort of said about the transparency issues. I think that's really key to this debate here. And when I was sort of talking about maybe in an ideal world when all of this data collection and analysis would be done within the NHS. And the reason that I think that is because there's a layer of transparency that takes place in these public bodies that we don't see in private and commercial companies such as Microsoft. There's a veil to the practices that perhaps we wouldn't have if it was taking place within a sort of a publicly funded body. My question for the future is that, because I think it's becoming increasingly obvious, certainly to me, that the key to getting this crisis under control is data. You know, if we look at countries that are successfully managing the crisis at the moment, or more successfully than the UK, one of the sort of features of it is the fact that people are tracking their symptoms and they have like a really clear idea of what the spread of the virus looks like within their boundaries. So it's becoming increasingly clear to me that, you know, data is key to getting this crisis under control. And I guess what I'm kind of saying is that maybe there's a way that this could be done with more transparency, so that we don't sort of have to have this concern in the back of our mind of, you know, what do we do once this is over? What are we going to be asked to give up in terms of our privacy in order to get this crisis under control? And how are we going to get it back once the crisis has abated?
I think there's two issues here. One, obviously, there's transparency, and I see the point or the potential problem with the private sector involvement is that they can often rely on the commercially sensitive argument when it comes to transparency. And of course, you have to have transparency first before you can have accountability. We need to know that something's gone wrong before you can take action against anyone who might be at fault for what's gone wrong. But I'm not sure I'm so optimistic that as entirely state-run approach would be that much better in terms of both transparency and accountability. And the other argument, I think, in favour of the private sector involvement in these cases is, you know, this is an unprecedented, and it's a word that's been overused, but if ever there was a case where the word was appropriate, it's today. This is an unprecedented crisis, and why would you limit yourself to, well, just involve the state or just involve the private sector? Why can't, if they can't do it at this time, they never will be able to do it. Can private and public sectors work in harmony, so harnessing as much data collection and analysis power as is possible?
Oh, you old cynic, you, Patrick. No, I think, you know, it's an absolutely, you know, it's a very good response in that, you know, we need to use what is available to us in order to kind of get this crisis under control. For me as well, it's sort of one of the issues that it raises is this idea of consent as well. So as researchers, we obviously know that we have a responsibility to obtain informed consent from our participants. And this is also a discourse that is fully present in the world of healthcare as well, this idea of informed consent. But it seems to me that within the whole sort of the plan, from what we can see it, there's a certain amount of ambiguity as to this data's final destination. And I sort of think that there's a world of difference between them saying that they're going to destroy this data or they're going to give it to the NHS. And it's sort of just raising some questions for me about the nature of, you know, when we're consenting to hand over this information about ourselves, what is the actual nature of that consent? Because can we really term it as fully informed consent if we're not entirely sure where that data is going to end up and in whose hands and for what purpose?
Yeah, I think the ethical use of data like this by governments actually requires a level of consent within the public. And I think at the moment there's probably a wide consensus that you know, people would rather, this is my guess, obviously I have no no evidence to back this up, but I should imagine that in a situation of crisis, you know, people have a tendency to you have to trust someone to try and resolve the crisis, and the government seems to be in the best position to do that. So I think in this moment, there's probably consent in that sense. But I think that quite often, it's easier to think of consent in the legalistic sense. So in terms of, can we use this data legally without relying on said informed consent, which is probably true in this case anyway, but that's a very different question to the ethical question of, will we continue to have this general sense of trust and consent post the crisis? I'm not sure that would be the case. I think now is definitely a special time. The use of this sort of large data sets combined together, etc., etc., even though there is huge potential for these to yield, you know, insights that could change how we evaluate policies and how we develop policies, it could be a game changer if the government could do this sort of thing in a bigger way beyond the crisis. But I'm not sure that there is consensus out there that there's public trust and consent in that sense to do that post the crisis. I don't know if I'm making any sense. I feel like I've rambled on a bit.
I mean, I think at the moment, consent, and I've used the word just consent there without the other words informed and explicit, but certainly, well, maybe explicit consent, I think at the moment would be very easy to get. But I think that consent needs to have some sort of sunset clause attached to it. So while people might be accepting of limits or restrictions on their privacy at the moment, you know, when the crisis is over, whenever that happens, then that consent needs to be revisited. So, you know, that's the danger as well, is that, you know, if there is some form of consent, and I agree with you, Sarah, I think there would be at the moment because of the ongoing crisis.
Yeah.
But that needs to be carefully monitored. So if the situation changed, as a basic GDPR principle, you can opt out at any time, I think is the bottom line.
Yeah. The data governance stuff is quite important going forward. I'm sure Kate will have something to say about this, but I think that in this moment of crisis, I think these companies are also benefiting from the experience of working with these enormous data sets and bringing them together in new ways and working out how to use them. So obviously, you know, they're being paid to do this job, but they're also going to benefit from doing this job in the first place in the future. And I think whatever data governance structures are kind of put in place, because I have no doubt that this kind of big data store style thing is going to, this is probably just the beginning of this kind of capability, but we definitely need the governance to be there to support this kind of work to be done in the public good, and not just so that a handful of companies can essentially hold governments to ransom because they have all of the capability and all of the know-how, which they can, you know, obviously it's their raison d'etre is to make money. So obviously that's what they're going to do with it. They're going to make money and not necessarily extract all of the public value in the sense of research. What are your thoughts on the governance side of things, Kate?
This is a really, really interesting one. And it's something that researchers in the Data Justice Lab have looked into in quite a lot of detail. And it's this aligning of sort of data governance and the idea of good citizenship. So we're collecting sort of these huge amounts of data about people. And the Data Justice Lab has sort of looked at the way in which the collation and processing of this these data, it's an increasing feature of governance, and it's being sort of used to inform our ideas about what good citizenship is. So if we look at the way kind of data are used to categorize citizenship in order to allocate services and sort of predict the future, that to me is quite a kind of interesting point. So if we think about, for example, when we finally come out of lockdown, the data that we're collecting is going to be used to see, to decide where people are safe to start coming out of lockdown, who is safe to start going back to work and to start returning to public life. And it kind of leaves space for ideas about areas of good citizenship and bad citizenship. You know, we're sort of leaving space for these kind of ideas about, you know, the good citizens are now allowed to come out of their houses and return to work and return to public life because they've followed the rules and they've got COVID-19 under control, whereas the bad citizens, they haven't. I've sort of seen some of these arguments and discourses with this kind of public shaming of people who are kind of breaking the lockdown. And you see these news stories of people in parks and public spaces with no contextualization about those individuals as, say, classed or gendered individuals and some of the kind of nuances that are taking place there. Is that what you mean? I feel like I suddenly just went off on a tangent.
I feel like you were talking about data being used in policy making and sort of making decisions. Yeah. I mean, I think all of that is super valid. I was kind of thinking about like the governance of the data rather than the governance that happens because of the data. That's all good. Patrick, you're a fan of regulation.
I am.
Do you think we've got this space regulated enough in terms of is regulating bulk collection of data and value extraction in any way possible or desirable, do you think? Or are we way past that now, given that people give away their data quite freely anyway and all of the time? And that seems to be the operational model for the vast majority of these kind of digitally based businesses and platforms.
Yeah, well, I think it's possible to regulate even more heavily, data gathering, collection, use, etc. Whether it's feasible is a different question, and whether it's feasible at a reasonable cost when there's so many other difficult choices that need to be made in terms of state expenditure is a different question. Yes, if you quadruple the staff in the Information Commission, for example, then you might adopt more stringent regulatory approaches. But of course, that's not feasible, and no government's going to make that decision when faced with, the need to increase spending on schools, particularly hospitals at this time, etc. And I think there could be some debate as to whether it's even desirable, as you said, because I think since the digital revolution, particularly the huge expansion of social media, what we mean by privacy, I think, has changed. And I think, generally speaking, people are more accepting of a greater level of intrusion in terms of privacy, because not least they put a lot of private information about themselves into the public domain on a routine basis. So I think in order to get the things the right way around, before you have a debate about, well, how best to regulate it, what resources are needed, what agencies are required, what powers are required, etc., then I think you need to start first with a debate about what we actually mean by privacy in the era of data collection, in the era of big data, etc. I think that has to come first, and then that would inform the regulatory scheme that followed. Now, I don't know the answer to that question. It is. I think it's a debate to be had. But what I am certain of is I think what is meant by privacy is evolving. And what we mean by privacy today in 2020 is very different than what was maybe meant by privacy 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. I think that to some extent, if the concern is, and in my case, I think that the key concern is a concern with social justice in a way, okay? Because I think that perversely, these companies are benefiting massively from the current crisis, because we're all just living through the internet at the moment, be it online shopping or, communication. If anything, and especially if a lot of the local businesses go out of business, in the current situation, it's the big retailers, online retailers, that are going to benefit, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one aspect of it. So they're massively benefiting through the crisis. They're also the companies that hold the key to resolve the crisis on one level. And then at the other end of it, because we've seen massive fiscal intervention from all, from across the world, the UK, the US, China, massive fiscal intervention by states. And eventually, who's going to pay for it is the citizen, through taxes, most likely. It's quite, in the bigger picture, I think this is quite a perverse situation in terms of social justice, and in terms of who reaps the benefits of the crisis itself, but also, the government response to the crisis perversely is just going to benefit the same five companies, most likely, more than anybody else. So this is something that kind of underlines my kind of interaction with these questions. That's sort of my impetus, or where I'm coming from, the thing that I'm actually concerned about. Any thoughts?
So I wonder if it's maybe a sort of a question of to what extent do the ends justify the means in this particular case? You know, we're sort of all in agreement that we need to get this under control, and we need to use the resources that are available to us in order to sort of, work our way through this crisis. And it is that sort of that age-old debate, isn't it? Do we do what's necessary to get through this? Are our actions justified by the fact that we will get this under control eventually, hopefully? It's quite an interesting... I don't think there's a podcast in the world long enough to get that debate under control.
And I think, as always, the solution that is advocated by various groups is ideologically driven. So, if you sort of, broadly speaking, of the right, then you might be more relaxed about private intervention, about profits on the back of the crisis, etc. If you're more left-leaning, then you might be more concerned about private intervention and see the solution as essentially statist. You know, it's something that needs to be driven by the public sector. So any debate will be influenced by that as well.
The solution very conveniently.
In a way that tallies with their worldview anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Although I think a lot of people on the right would also be, or on the right in the sense of free market kind of advocates, would still be concerned with this incredible monopoly that exists, you know, in the hands of, you know, the five companies or whatever, I haven't counted them in a while, but, you know, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Amazon. Monopolies aren't good for business, they have a tendency to, well, first of all, they don't behave by market rules, but also we see it all the time with these big companies buying off smaller companies to essentially not allow them to compete. Right, and all this. So I think maybe on this point there could be a wider consensus across the ideological divide that, you know, it's not really good for anybody to have five companies in charge of the world. Maybe. This has got very political. Our podcast doesn't usually get this political.
Oh, doesn't it?
No.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pity, because I was going to sort of try and change the chat tack slightly and ask some questions about a kind of an intersectional approach to COVID-19. And I don't think that's going to help with our political problem at all.
Oh, go on. I think we've got a few more minutes, and I think this would be a good place to end it, because I think we've covered quite a bit, but we haven't talked at all about this idea of intersectionality. So what were you thinking?
Well, so some of my sort of thoughts and observations as I've been kind of watching this sort of crisis unfold, there's been a couple of things that have caught my attention. So the Trades Union Council have raised some concerns about Black and minority ethnic workers and sort of asked, is there something going on with the virus that makes BAME people more susceptible? Is the mortality rate higher in BAME workers? And similarly, The Guardian have raised some concerns about the proportion of men to women who seem to be contracting the virus and sort of having a higher mortality rate. So when we're talking about sort of this sort of mass collection of data and this idea of ends justifying the means and all of that, and I wonder if these questions are being asked, because I'm not seeing much in the way of actually addressing these problems from the government at the moment. You know, I'm not seeing much in the way of the people in charge of responding to this crisis. Are they asking, is there something going on here that makes, say, men more susceptible or people from Black or minority ethnic backgrounds more susceptible. So if we're thinking about like the ends justifying the means and all of these subjects, I guess what I'm asking is, in terms of an intersectional approach, are we doing enough to actually understand this virus?
The different ways in which it's affecting like different groups.
Yeah,
I was trying to find this article that I read. I think it was on, it might have been on the New Yorker. I will dig it out and I will add it to the show notes. But it was by a historian, an academic who has written about, it might have been the Spanish flu. And how governments introduced these cards that people, at one point, you had a card that said that you had already had it. And if you hadn't already had it, then, you know, employers wouldn't employ you. And that so essentially, in the aftermath of this massive pandemic, all of these, essentially, people who were already structurally disadvantaged basically suffered a lot more, and the regulation that came in to try and contain the aftermath and make sure that it didn't come back again, disproportionately affecting certain people. That's definitely something that historically has happened before. So maybe it's definitely worth keeping an eye on and making sure that the data is being used to actually bring these issues to light and sort of make them visible.
No, I completely agree. I've seen those stories as well, sort of bouncing around in this idea of carrying around a immunity card kind
immunity
of
immunity card, that's it.
In this context, they call it an immunity passport, didn't they?
Immunity passports, Would it be blue or red, we ask ourselves.
That is the big question.
There's a very good occasional show on Radio 4 called The Long View with Jonathan Friedland, the Guardian columnist. And he often picks two points in history very, very distant in terms of time. And it's amazing how often history repeats itself and how often the solutions are the same.
Yeah.
The 2018 Spanish flu pandemic, you know, the solution there is now being proposed with a different title. 2020.
Cool. Well, would you, either of you, like to add anything? I think this, maybe we can leave it here. We've had I think we've had a good go at this topic.
Just to thank you for inviting me on. I've had a great time chatting with everyone and hope you've enjoyed it as well.
good. Do you have any free advertising? So this is a thing that we often do at the end of the podcast, which is sharing, advertising something that we think is cool or was amusing or any of the above that you'd like to share with the listeners, or something to do with your work or the Data Justice Lab's work, anything that you'd like to share.
I guess I could just direct people to the data governance projects that the Data Justice Lab have continued and they've published now. And just this idea about sort of good citizenship now being kind of directed by data collection. So they've kind of looked at the ways in which data is used to categorize citizenship. It's been used to allocate services and sort of predict the future. And of course, we know that data doesn't just exist within some sort of,
vacuum.
It's not like that at all. You know, there's a lot of things that go into data collection and whatever, and they've done sort of a really good job of kind of examining that. So if that point is of any interest to you, I would recommend having a look at the Data Justice Lab's website. That's my plug for the day, and you're welcome.
Excellent. Very good. Have you got any free advertising, Patrick? Oh no, have we lost you, Patrick?
I'm back now.
Oh, you're back.
Welcome back.
Oh, it's a good thing that you weren't online when Kate was saying all those terrible things about you just now.
Still, he's back now, so we should stop
talking
about it.
Quite a nice segue, actually, into our next podcast where we'll be discussing the digital divide.
Yes.
Ooh, my lack of reliable Wi-Fi.
Yeah. We were just doing some free advertising, and I was wondering if you had anything that you wanted to give a shout to before we go.
there's not much going on in the traditional way. but for anyone who's listening, who's got an interest in cyber matters, cyber crime, terrorism, etc., then just to let know that we're still open for applications on our innovative and brilliant MA in cyber crime and terrorism.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, excellent. And I've got one which has got, which is not as serious as yours, where either of yours were. It's essentially, I'll add this to the show notes, but it's a company that is essentially selling farm animals and particularly llamas. So you can subscribe and they will add a farm animal to your Zoom calls. So you can surprise everybody on your Zoom call by having a llama join you. So that really amused me this week.
It's not just animals, Sarah, is it? You can have goats, pigs.
Yeah, you can have, there's a full range of animal farms, that farm animals that you can have. I am seriously considering starting a side hustle with a cat. there's got to be a market out there for Zoom cats.
Well, I'm making a Zoom apparel online store.
Yeah.
Where like all in one, looks like a suit that you can easily put your arms in. And so whatever's below sort of chest.
Like, Patrick, that's been done.
It's been done.
It's been done.
Always too late.
maybe you could try other ranges of, you know.
I have to recall my email that was sent to Dragon's Den now, aren't I?
Brilliant. Okay, fab. Well, thank you very much, both of you, and thank you to our listeners, and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, I'm going to do it. Just going to have a sip of my tea. What was that?
Oh, sorry. I have a guess. It was Katie Vaughan inviting you to a Zoom meeting.
You're joking.
Oh, honest to God.
So as regular listeners of our podcast will know, all 25 of them, this is almost a feature, I think, that whenever we record, we get a phone call from Katie Vaughan.
Yes, again.
Amazing. So anyway, as I was saying,